Hello and welcome to the Press Gallery, the Edmonton Journal's Alberta Politics Podcast. It's Friday, December 6th, 2019, and this is episode number 301, the Rising House Temperature Edition. I'm your host, Janet French. With me today in studio, we have reporter Lisa Johnson. How are you?
Aloha, Janet. I'm great. Aloha. How are you?
I wish I was experiencing aloha.
It's a state of mind. You can.
Lay it right on. Good morning, Dave Breckenridge,
our
managing editor. How are you?
Fantastic.
Wonderful. Joining us late as always is legislature columnist Keith Gerine.
I was here on the dot of 9:30.
It was 9:32.
Not according to my clock.
Your clock is not correct. Well, thank goodness that's done, that sitting. There's probably a lot of relieved people today. Hansard scribes, security guards, clerks, random media who work in the press gallery. Maybe some politicians are relieved that sitting is over, but probably not because they did it to themselves. So whatever. Today we're going to talk about people having trouble getting along, respectful relationships, congenial disagreement.
That's politics.
So it is. Yeah. As the sitting wraps up, there seems to be a lot of strained relationships, not only between the government and the opposition, but also the provincial government and other levels of government and the provincial government and the federal government and people in their federal government and people in their provincial government and Alberta and its place in the country. But first, let's just review some of the last few months in this sitting. Calgary Herald columnist Don Braid said of the last 9 weeks that the UCP government has, quote, fundamentally changed the Alberta government by ripping apart virtually the entire NDP superstructure. I wasn't aware there was an NDP superstructure, but, you know, good to know.
It can't have been that super.
No, 4 years, right?
Yeah.
Apparently not fortified.
They got fired.
Yes.
As the government is wont to say.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the fall sitting of the 30th legislature ended at about 1:30 a.m. Thursday after MLAs passed 16 pieces of government legislation, one private member's bill, and a handful of symbolic motions that I don't think I've bothered reporting on. Something about gun ownership and wearing pro-oil and gas clothing in the gallery. Anyway, some of the changes that are a little bit more foundational include creating an Alberta Indigenous Opportunities Corporation, which gives loan guarantees and some loans and some advice to Indigenous groups that want to start up resource projects. There's also Claire's Law, which gives people who might be at risk of domestic violence some new tools that they could use to find out more about their partners. There was the biggest budget cutback in spending in a quarter century to address what the government says is overspending by the province. The government also reversed some farm safety and workers' rights legislation that was brought in by the NDP and was wildly controversial. They reversed the ban on replacement workers during strikes. So couldn't used to bring in scabs, as the unions like to call them. Now you can just scab away. They changed the management and control of public sector pensions. They eliminated various funds, offices, corporate entities, boards, and fired the election commissioner. Oh, that. They allowed political parties to merge. They froze the indexation of income tax brackets. I could go on. I'd probably be here all day if I listed every single change that they realized. So yesterday, Jason Nixon, who's the House leader, got up in front of reporters at the legislature and said, hey, we have accomplished 162 things, or are on our way, substantially on our way to accomplishing 162 things of the 375 things that were in the United Conservative Party's election platform. Go us. What do you think are some of the government's biggest accomplishments this session? The sitting.
Well, you mentioned some of them. I think the Indigenous Opportunities Corporation could be a good thing down the road. The centerpiece legislation of all this was the budget. And so they came in. The election promise was actually to freeze spending for 4 years. So Jason Kenney has tried to justify that they need to go beyond that. And so they came in with a 2.8% overall cut. That's the first one in a quarter century. That's significant. And we are still, I think, feeling some of the ripple effects from that. Some of the announcements are still dribbling out about what those cuts actually mean. So I think that is probably the thing that's going to linger, that some of the changes to the labor legislation may come into play in the months to come if there is, in fact, some kind of labor action. Those, I think, are some of the big things. And then the TIER program as well, right? The new environmental regime, emissions regime that the government is putting in there. That's, I think, starting up early next year. And that could have some profound impacts on what message Alberta sends to the world in terms of whether we're doing our part to help with the climate change issue.
And we just found out this morning that the federal government will, in fact, accept the TIER regimen as equivalent to the federal carbon tax on heavy emitters. I don't know why I'm talking like this.
So that means that the federal carbon tax on heavy emitters won't be forced upon Alberta.
No, yeah. The Alberta version of our TIER version will apply to heavy emitters rather than the federal liberal industrial tax applying to us. But the consumer tax...
still coming in January.
Sorry.
Depending on the court challenge.
Yes.
Yes.
Court action permitting. How would you describe the pace of what we saw, you know, these 16 pieces of government legislation in 9 weeks? How does that compare to previous governments? That's not even including other announcements that didn't require legislation. There were regulation changes. There were program announcements. How does the pace of what they're doing compare to what we've seen by other governments?
I haven't looked at like the numbers of bills that the NDP passed in its first couple sittings, but it feels like it's been brisk. It feels like they're looking to get a lot done in a short period of time, which when you have a government that campaigned on making big change to undo, as they've said, this, you know, the summer of repeal was the summer sitting, and then the fall sitting is more change, that it feels brisk, but it also is in line with, I think, what people maybe should have expected from a party that campaigned on undoing a lot of what the previous government had done. I don't know.
That hired lawyers before they were even elected to start drafting legislation.
Stuff like that.
And to, what was their thing about consultation?
That they've been consulting this whole
right,
like
no, the but they're Kenny saying like to, they, yeah anyway
tour around Alberta in a truck, and he consulted with Albertans, and the election was a consultation, and
every single one of them.
Like I saw some media pundits at this table complaining about, you know, the speed of like the way that government was operating, and I know that like there is a strategy in politics to take a shotgun approach and get as much done as possible in a short period of time so people can't necessarily take a deeper look at things. But I also feel that, I don't know, I don't see the pace as necessarily a bad thing. I think the things that warranted controversy got controversy. And I think the things that are kind of like, oh, well, you know, Clare's Law, everyone agreed on, the public, like it seemed like it had bipartisan support. So, you know, it's not going to generate as much fire as other things. I think the things that really ticked people off, we all heard about.
We heard about them, but I think there's some of them, especially some of the cuts that are coming through the budget. The fact that we're not indexing increases to seniors' benefits anymore. The fact that a bunch of seniors are going to lose their drug benefits, or senior dependents are going to lose their drug benefits. I don't think we have necessarily looked at all of those things. The changes to biosimilars or biologics and forcing people to go on biosimilars again, I don't think this is necessarily received as much attention as maybe it could. And I think the danger is when you pass legislation and make as many changes as you do to a budget, there is the possibility of some bad decisions. And the opposition, the media, advocates can't necessarily keep up with it. And we will not necessarily find out about some of the impacts of these until they actually come into force next year at some point. So that I think is where the danger is. Now, hopefully the government has done its research. But I wouldn't surprise me if there are a few of these decisions they may need to rethink in the new year.
I think one of the things that will be interesting, and it kind of goes to Keith's point about some things in the past budget getting lost because it came as part of a very busy legislative session as well, is that we will see a new budget in 2 months.
In February.
Yeah. And so, which makes sense because they need to have a new budget at the proper time in the fiscal year. And it is common when a government is elected in late spring that they will do an interim budget in the fall. But a lot of that will get kind of lost in the shuffle because there will be a whole new host of potential cuts and potential issues that some of these other ones may not get as much attention because we'll be looking at the 2020-2021 plan. So that he, Keith does have a point on that. There may be some things that we saw this fall that we may just have to put aside as reporters because we have to report on something new
the next set
in 2 months.
Of thingies.
And a budget is a big thing. Yes.
Yes. Thank you. That was an understatement. what do you think is the most noteworthy? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of talk about all the promises and the commitments that they achieved or were fulfilling. Is there anything that they did not do or that they did that they said they wouldn't do that really stands out as like, nah.
Well, I mean, you could pick any number of things. Like they talked about not de-indexing AISH, but they de-indexed AISH payments. I mean, you get into the quibbling over, like, you know, cuts to healthcare. Well, they're increasing health spending, but then there are job losses in the healthcare sector. So where does that, how does that count in the tally? And same with education. They've funded enrollment growth, but they got rid of the class size
initiative and the classroom improvement fund.
Yeah, so
and
where
the
does
bill
that,
one
how does that all come out in the wash?
It comes out at less money per student, right? So the dollar value is the same, but there's going to be a larger number of students.
Exactly.
So the amount per student is lower.
Yes.
It's interesting, Dave, that you mentioned. I mean, this is what you should reasonably have expected from this government, a lot of these things. But, you know, being at the Edmonton Public School Board meeting recently, when they were discussing their budget and having to cash in an $80 million surplus that they'd been sitting on just to kind of keep the lights on and keep going, they talked a lot about how they prepared for this budget last year. You know, they knew some things were going to be gone. They knew some special funding programs were more than likely going to get cut. They prepared for that, but they were not prepared for what actually came.
Yeah. And I agree that this is, you know, especially in the areas of health and education, I know that there's criticism that, and we might talk about some of that criticism in a little bit from the government of public school boards and how they manage their money. But at the end of the day, you know, they talked about during the election about maintaining frontline services, which I think Albertans want. There may be a looming fight between public sector unions and the government that I think the government is hoping that the public will side with the purse holders as opposed to the unions. But at the same time, they want to see hospitals staffed and schools fully staffed on all of those things. And I think that the government has to find a way to message that well to convince the public. Because at the end of the day, people with kids in schools don't want to have like their kids in class, larger classes, or they want to make sure the teachers are there. Or, you know, my kid's school had to let go of their librarian due to funding. Like, everyone loved the librarian, apparently. You know, it's these things that become tangible for Albertans. And I think the government, in a kind of a bigger fight against what they may call special interests, may forget how the public views the role that some of these people play individually in their lives.
Well, I think it's going to be some of the full effects are not apparent yet, and we won't really know them until the politicians go back into the community and we as reporters get more of a chance to go back out into the community and talk to people who are, because it's personal stories that illustrate how policies trickle down to humans and the effect on humans. And I think that gets lost, right? We just talk so much about the merits or drawbacks of policy or whether it's a good idea, but I think we need to hear from actual
human beings
that are living it.
On a practical level, we still don't know the funding formula going forward.
Yeah, not till the end of September, August 2020 for education.
Right.
Yeah, all we talk about, Lisa and I, now is education. Yeah. The rest of it.
It's a hot topic.
Irrelevant, yeah. Can't we just all get along, you guys?
No.
What? No. Yesterday, the legislature was in a bit of a mood.
They were tired after...
They were more... Yes, the press gallery
party
Christmas party.
The night before.
It wasn't even a rager. It's just people are surly, man. They're just in a mood. If you watch Question Period at all, this session and... Sitting session, both apply. Who wouldn't? Or went to a press conference in the last 9 weeks. Here are some things you would have seen or heard. Both parties accusing each other of telling untruths, spreading misinformation, or outright lying. Accusations of corruption. The government claiming that the NDP is only angry about anything because they lost the election. The opposition claiming that every single cutback or change is due to the corporate tax cut, which has only just begun maybe 6 months ago and hasn't even reached its full vigor, its full implementation, and won't for 4 years. And arguments over who is the worst finance minister in the province's history, with various finger pointing. I'm just wondering what your takes are on how would you describe the tenor of the debate that we have seen.
Is this like a contest where we can come up with the best word? Can we get points for which one of us comes up with
the best? Yes, I will award points. On a scale of 1 to 100.
Yes, acrimonious? Is that too basic?
I used that in my story. That was okay. My lead. Yeah, that's only stealing.
Dumpster fire.
Oh, good one.
Dumpster fire. Okay, yeah. I'll give that a 42.
Oh. Yeah, I was going to go with rancorous maybe, but yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Give it a 69.
The frustrating part about it is that both parties have their party lines, and it's like they're having two different debates with themselves rather than actually like talking about a specific issue.
Not just call it an echo chamber, did you?
That's the word I'm looking for. I mean, it's...
She's just shaking her head like, I got no time for this crap. How did we arrive at this like polarized place, right? We used to have multiple parties in there. There'd be kind of, I mean, obviously some were more outnumbered than others, but it seems very dichotomous.
I think it's a number of things. I think the election was very contentious. I think that there are a lot of people, you know, formerly in government, now in opposition, who really, really, really don't like members of the current government. I think on a personal level, there are people who really don't like the premier. And I think on the flip side, there are people in the government who really, really, really don't like the NDP. I think that you went right from an election into a summer session, a summer sitting of the legislature that was busy. They didn't slow down in August. You hit the federal election campaign and the government here didn't slow down. Then you had a very contentious budget. And amid all of that, there's been fines handed out in relation to the UCP leadership campaign and the NDP trying to make hay out of that. And just the noise starts to get louder. And then with the government doing so many things through the session, the opposition is trying to make itself heard as well. And so they need to be louder and they need to create more controversy. And so you see them every day with a new aggrieved group and press releases with screaming all caps headlines about corruption. And it just reaches a fever pitch. And so you get testy about things like booking the media room.
Just for example.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was the most latest thing.
That's where I was going to go next. So I don't think we strictly reported on this, but there's one of the tensions that has cropped up lately, and it's been sort of a running joke, and yesterday it became less of a joke, is that there's a little room with like a little stage and microphones and flags and a podium media room in the legislature where most, you wouldn't know this if you're just watching on TV, but it's where most of the press conferences would happen with members from government and sometimes members of the opposition. And earlier, I can't remember whether it started in the summer or the fall, where they started kind of, I'm not going to get into the details, but each party was trying to block the other party from the media room by booking it for increasingly larger blocks of time. So what it causes us to do is now for most NDP press conferences, and this is a very first world problem, we have to walk about like 10 minutes through this tunnel or through the legislature grounds to the federal building and go past this through this like security checkpoint. So it's a bit of a nuisance to, you can't just walk around the corner and have your politician available. And the NDP has, they claim they're the latest victim of this and that they're blocked out and that they've had scrums in the atrium and then like the rotunda and then like the fountain like psh goes on and then the audio is all screwed so they've been sort of experimenting with various locations. But yesterday, this got sort of weird. Lisa witnessed some of the tensions in person. Can you tell us what happened yesterday?
Well, we went to the media room expecting a 10:45 NDP presser. And things got really tense. The premier's communications people were obviously upset that it was being set up and immediately kind of shut it down. And very quickly we learned that the NDP had relocated to the federal building, so we were getting ready to move. But it really cheesed off a lot of journalists that we were kind of like these children caught in the middle of a fight between mom and dad, and we had to pack up our stuff, go to grandma's house. Like it was, it really affected a lot of people in the press gallery. Like the tension spilled over way beyond just like kind of a bickering between these two parties. It was bizarre. And it also seemed like silly because the NDP could have had a presser at 10:45 and been well on its way to packing up well before Jason Nixon had his press conference. So it seems like they could just get along.
And some of our colleagues were asking questions like, if you can't agree when to book a room in a shared building, how are you supposed to run this province? Which is,
I mean, I saw some of the tweets yesterday and I was like, oh man, like the media complaining about it are going to come out looking worse than the government or the opposition on this. I'm pretty sure. But I understand. So essentially it sounds like the NDP had wanted to get the room for 10:45, but then the government didn't want the NDP to talk before the minister. And according to one NDP staffer, they had a verbal agreement that they could use the room at 10:45. And so they were accusing the government of being classless. But then after that, the premier's director of communications tweeted out an email exchange between the deputy press secretary for the office of the premier and one of the communications officers for the NDP. And it sounds like they had a perfectly fine, congenial conversation. This is from the NDP. I see Nixon is now going up at 12. Can we get in after still instead of 10:45 like we talked about yesterday? And the deputy press secretary for the premier, sure thing. You'll be set to respond after the house leader. Thanks. This is more than an hour before the scheduled NDP presser. So it sounds like someone in the NDP office didn't like that and said, let's just go down there for 10:45 anyway and make a stink out of it. They're playing like it's just politics and games and they look childish.
This is where we're at now. We are now having to tweet out email exchanges between various communication folks in both parties to prove who had the room and who didn't have the room. This is the state of things at the moment. It is kind of ridiculous, but it does stem from a lot of what Dave was talking about some of the acrimony, the rancor that we have seen play out in more serious venues. And question period to me is almost unwatchable these days. The NDP tries to get in the $4.7 billion tax cut into almost every question, and the government tries to get into every answer that Albertans fired the NDP government, and they have the worst finance minister in the history of Alberta sitting over on their side, and on and on, with very little actual legitimate questions being asked, very little legitimate answers being answered. And it is really, really kind of painful to watch and how repetitive it is. And that is just, that is carried through to a lot of the government business and a lot of the press conferences and the tone of this. I think the firing of the election commissioner was a real turning point. Mm-hmm. I think that really did send some legitimate anger from the NDP. I think they heard a lot of that legitimate anger from Albertans as well. And so they really ramped things up. And since then, things have been, I think we saw the session end the last couple of weeks with some higher temperatures than you might normally see.
Isn't this normal, though? Shouldn't it be expected that an official opposition kicks up dust whenever they can?
That's their job.
Yeah. It is their job.
Yes. This has felt a little higher than usual. We'll see. Maybe it'll tone down in the new year. I wouldn't bet on it, though.
Yeah, I don't remember. I think the only other time I remember around December when things got really kind of testy was around Jim Prentice and Bill 10, and this whole, the debate around that got fairly heated.
That would be gay straight alliances in school.
Yes. Yeah. And that was 2014. And I remember like it went in again around the press gallery Christmas party and it just felt very heated at the time, but I don't think it would felt this dialed up.
Speaking of heated, the sniping is not limited to the legislature. We've also got some sniping going back and forth between cabinet ministers and like mayors of large cities, and the Minister of Municipal Affairs telling the cities of Edmonton and Calgary that yeah, so like we cut your funding, but there's absolutely no reason for you to be imposing a tax increase, a property tax increase on your residents. Hint, wink. We got Justice Minister Doug Schweitzer lobbing some, I think calling Naheed Nenshi Trudeau's mayor is supposed to be an insult. Is that an insult?
Yeah. In Alberta, it's intended as an insult.
Okay,
definitely
right.
An insult.
Yeah. Shrug. and we've got the education minister repeatedly accusing, and at times the finance minister, accusing the Calgary Board of Education of financial mismanagement, criticizing their firing of teachers when they received much less money in the provincial budget than they had anticipated. And then...
Both things can be true, though. We can get
absolutely,
into some of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But now the education minister is ordering independent reviews, ordering an independent audit. And this is 2 years after the previous NDP government had already ordered an independent look inside the Calgary Board of Education and found like not that much wrong. Now, some of the critics looking at this tactic are saying basically it's victim blaming, right? You cut their budgets and then now you're turning to them and criticizing them and insulting them. Why would the government use this tactic?
I mean, to get people on their side. Nobody likes property tax hikes.
I love them.
Yeah.
More property tax hikes.
Generally speaking, no one likes the tax they pay on their home or their condo to go up every year. And depending on the rate, it goes up. Edmonton, I think, has done a better job than Calgary of keeping property taxes closer to the rate of inflation plus population growth. I don't think Calgary has done as good a job of doing that. And I think that's why more of the anger has been directed at Calgary than Edmonton. But, and at the same time, Edmonton's mayor and some councillors on Edmonton City Council are talking like, yeah, like they're cutting our fund. We can't turn around and we have to find savings because residents don't want to see anything higher than the already discussed 2.6% property tax hike. But it is all about fighting. Like province... Aside from Ralph Klein, who just threw money at cities to tell them to shut up so I can go win an election, there's been like, they like to, Doug Griffiths was no fan of the cities. He would complain when cities asked for more money when he was a municipal affairs minister. Allison Redford, when there was talk of like arena funding from the province for Edmonton, I remember Allison Redford basically saying, look, we give them enough money. We don't like, they have to make their own decisions and work with their own priorities. Like, so the idea that, this isn't new. This is heightened. I will say the tone is very much more admonishing than in the past.
Quite direct.
Yeah. Do you assume, especially with Calgary, that city council isn't as popular as it once was, and Naheed Nenshi is not as popular as he was when he won his first election in 2010. They think they may have an easy target and a way to gain some sympathy for them by pointing blame at the cities, which is fair, especially like this week the Calgary just signed an arena deal and then they're complaining about infrastructure money. I don't think that goes over well with a lot of people.
However, this is a government and a premier I've never seen the like of in terms of their need to have confrontation and their need to have enemies, foils. This has been Jason Kenney's MO since he came back onto the provincial politics scene, picking fights, riling up his base by saying to Albertans, or at least his base, that there are enemies, that there are people that are messing up their lives, that Albertans are getting a raw deal for a variety of reasons because of various forces out there. And so I've made a little list. Like, here's people that this government and this premier are picking fights with. The leaders of Edmonton and Calgary, as we mentioned, labor unions. They're going after rural municipalities now with this new policing deal, which they're increasing police, but asking those municipalities to pay for it. Justin Trudeau and the Liberal government, Quebec. Jason Kenney went after Moody's this week, the credit rated agency that actually downgraded Alberta's credit rating once more. And he's suggesting that they're basically part of the global eco-terrorist cabal.
They've been sucked in by a European conspiracy.
Exactly.
That's what he said on the radio.
That's right. Yeah. So environmentalists, foreign funded, U.S. foundations are on the list. He's going after academics. He's going after university students. He's going after nurses, doctors, teachers. This is just some of the list. Now, this is getting quite extensive, and you start to wonder, if you start picking fights with all of these people, who's going to be left to vote for you in 4 years? This is the thing I don't quite understand. Now, some of this is a natural consequence of being a conservative leader and presenting a budget that is got some cuts that are coming to the public service. I don't think labor unions were ever going to be on Jason Kenney's side, but this does start to feel like... this starts to feel like a strategy that doesn't have a happy ending, and I question why the premier is going to this extent just to keep his base happy, because I think at some point the numbers tip in favor of the people who he's angered rather than the people who he's getting to support him here.
Just wondering if Lisa has heard anything from school boards about in response to this, because one of the things that really surprised me was the criticism of the Calgary Board of Education, and particularly asking for a governance review, like a look at the board level, because many of the people who were elected to that board were elected as a slate of conservative aligned people. So if I thought they were going to go after any school board from a political, you know, animosity level, that wasn't the one I would have pointed to. Is there anything you've heard from other school boards about what they think about the government's particular approach to local governments right now?
Interestingly, the Edmonton Catholic School Board has been mired in an entirely different controversy
lately.
So they haven't even dealt with this directly. But the Edmonton Public School Board, at the last meeting that I was at, the trustees made it very clear that they felt like they were being bamboozled, essentially having these costs, extra costs downloaded on them with increased enrollment and a funding freeze, which essentially amounted to a cut for them. They repeatedly said, this is not our fault. We are being put into this position. This is not due to our mismanagement. In fact, we're in a lucky position because we've managed our finances so well, we're actually able to keep our head above water for this school year. And not reopen the budget in the middle of the school year. So it's interesting that there are essentially two very different messages that I think parents would be hearing. One from the government that's saying, no, everything's hunky-dory. We've got a few.
You don't have to cut teachers. We didn't take that much money away.
No, there's just some school boards that are mismanaging their finances. That's the problem over here.
Well, what happens when all the school boards run out of reserves?
Exactly.
Right? Or is there going to be a governance review of every school board in this province? That's going to get kind of expensive.
And just silly. Like, as Keith said, like, it's at what point does this go against the government's favor? And that's when you'd start seeing, I think, public opinion start to sway against them. The idea that, like, school boards rely on the province. They're not allowed to collect taxes on their own anymore. The province collects the education taxes collects property taxes and then doles out money to the cities.
And they said the province sets the tax rate.
Yeah. So the school board is entirely reliant on the province for their funding. And you have a board with a surplus and that has been managing its money well. And then it runs out of its surplus because it's not getting, like, what do you cut at that point?
Well, what you need is more students. You need to steal more students because students are dollars. Mm-hmm. If I'm a school board, I get more aggressive at recruitment to try and get my student dollars. Anyway, I'm not a school board. I am a reporter, and now we're going to tell you some cool stuff to read. Lisa?
You want me to start?
Yeah, because I'd like to do it counterclockwise, and you're there.
Oh, I thought maybe I was special.
You are special. You're extremely special. Tell me, I every Thursday night, I just lay in my bed, and I'm like, what is Lisa going to recommend this week? I cannot wait.
Edge of your seat. Seriously. I actually came across an article last night, the 11th hour, that really got me thinking and took my breath away. It was a really well-written article. It's not very long. A journalist out of Ottawa named Haneen Al-Hassoun wrote about what she described on Twitter as a taboo and sensitive topic in the Muslim community, but it's a reality that can't be ignored. The name of the article is Why Some Muslim Women Take Off the Hijab, and it's really fascinating, and it is written by a Muslim woman who wears a hijab. I'd highly recommend this good stuff.
I like legit really want to read that right now. Like, I just want to stop this podcast and be like, bye guys. Dave?
Mine is not a serious topic this year marks the 30th anniversary of the release of the Christmas classic National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I don't know if you're a fan of that movie or not. Wow. Some people love it. Some people hate it. It's become a must watch every Christmas in our house. So I'm going to recommend, if you haven't seen it, to watch it if it's on TV, or maybe pick up the DVD because it's not available on streaming services that I've been able to find. But I'm also going to recommend there's a good piece from the National Post from its 25th anniversary. It's a Wonderful Strife, the Remarkable Legacy of National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. It's a good read, and it's a funny, it's just a nice, light, fun Christmas movie. And I don't like Chevy Chase that much, but I like this movie.
You're just like 100% nostalgia all the time.
Yeah.
Whatever floats your boat. I am going to recommend the first part of a series by our colleague at the Financial Post, Jeffrey Morgan, who works out of Calgary. And I was thinking about this the other day. Like, we really haven't had that many stories because we haven't really had time to talk about, tell some of the human stories about what it's like in rural Alberta right now. We talk about economic downturn and job numbers and blah, blah, blah. It's all very statistics-based and policy-based, but Jeffrey actually went to some small towns, went to Hannah, talked about just what it means to shut down coal there, what the energy policies mean for them. It's just a really nice mix of showing the human cost and the human toll, just like what real estate prices have absolutely bottomed out there. And then how do you recover that from that while still trying to understand, you know, intellectually, well, is this environmentally the correct path, right? Anyway, Keith.
I'm going to recommend a piece that posted in CBC from Murray Brewster. Murray Brewster was one of the, has been one of the foremost Canadian experts on the Afghan war. He spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, and I read a lot of his stuff when I went there in 2011. So he's kept up with a lot of the fallout from that war, and he's got a piece called "The Forgotten Afghan-Canadian Combat Advisors Seek Help and Recognition." And these combat advisors are Canadian citizens of Afghan descent that were sent over to Afghanistan to provide intelligence and to integrate themselves into Afghan society and learn what the Taliban was up to. They put themselves at risk, and when they came home, it appears that the Department of National Defense has not really looked after their needs to some degree. They faced some persecution from Afghans here back in Canada, and have had other issues, PTSD and so on, that Canada has perhaps not lived up to its obligations there. So it was an interesting piece looking at that small but very important group of people that that helped Canada in the war.
Sounds interesting. Well, that is all the time we have for today. If you've got some feedback, you can email me at jfrench@postmedia.com. Join us next week for another episode of The Press Gallery.